Podcast 235, Review of a Pig in a Day.
Sponsored by my buddies at PantryParadis.com. They sell food preservation tools. Produce, prepare, preserve your own harvest.
Brains!
So they were, when you eat the whole pig, when you eat all the pig, you're going to eat the brains. And so I'm here with Richard, Jocelyn, and Brandon. And I think when the brains came up, oh, Forrest is here too. Forrest, I'm sure, will be a chatterbox. We won't be able to get him to be quiet. Forrest agrees with me on everything, by the way. but when the brain stuff came up, I think Richard flinched a bit, no way. Plus, you know, maybe that's like you don't have any inner zombie, and so that way it's not appealing. But the key is that everybody here but Brandon watched Brandon's movie yesterday. And by movie, I mean it's an hour and a half split into three chunks. But it's the Farmstead Meatsmith stuff. And now if I just Google Farmstead Meatsmith, I'm pretty sure it comes up. But
yeah,
the three videos were on a site that had a different name. What was, right. What was that?
They're the name of the series, which is The Anatomy of Thrift. And anatomyofthrift.com is the website. And it's a series of three videos that are beautiful and instructive, all pertaining to how you can best use pork, starting from the pig in the field all the way to charcuterie in your kitchen and dinner on the table.
So I think I've got a bit of a reputation that when I'm sitting in the same room as somebody that I'll still totally lambast them and harsh their smooth. but I'm going to say I enjoyed those three free videos more than the DVD that we just watched, which we watched Pig in a Day with Hugh and Ray. And this is something that Maddie Harlan sent me from Permanent Publications. So it's probably at her Green Shopping site. I think it's greenshopping.uk or something like that. But if you go to the Permaculture Magazine website, you'll probably be able to find it pretty easily. But it was 2 hours and 20 minutes. I did like this video. I like this DVD myself. I just kind of thought that... I think people would like it a whole lot more if they didn't watch your three video series. And now your videos, three half-hour segments, are free.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's no DVD involved or anything like that. You just go to the website and watch it. It's actually hosted, I think, at Vimeo, not at YouTube.
Right.
Right. And for a moment, I think the thing to talk about with your videos is that there was a bit of art, a bit of poetry, and a bit of humor and comedy. And there was humor and comedy in this one, but I think I thought your stuff was funnier. but I enjoyed it more watching those. The Pig of the Day stuff also covered a little bit about raising the hogs a bit. And then they kind of went into more cooking, like more details of the cooking of different dishes. But your video series also had a little bit of cooking, but it also had a little bit of history and talked a little bit how people became disconnected from their food. Mm-hmm. And then I thought a rather poetic piece is when you talk about Ebenezer, who I'm assuming is a fictitious person from way back.
Mm-hmm.
Is he fiction or is he like a real dude?
He is a symbol, so he's as real as symbols are.
Okay, all right. So, and Ebenezer really loved his pigs, and then he thought they were really tasty also. But I think when I watched it, I kind of got this feeling of like the love that he felt for these animals was extended into the part where he eats them. And so then it's like this rather beautiful poetic relationship with the food.
Grokking.
So Forrest does speak. If you're all worried, so Forrest says grokking. So if you're thinking of it as like from Heinlein's fictional, also fictional piece, Stranger in a Strange Land, where it was a form of cannibalism. Like the idea that somebody would die and you wouldn't eat it. You wouldn't eat that meat would be offensive. That would be rude to the person. That would be wasteful. That would be disrespectful. Mm. But that was like something presented in a book that is definitely a long ways away from reality. However, I think Ebenezer does represent a reality that definitely, truly, once was. Mm-hmm. I think that the key is that a lot of people are like, oh, I couldn't, a lot of vegan or a vegetarian thought is, I couldn't eat that because it has a face, because it has a soul, because it has feelings. And it seems like Ebenezer had far more respect for these animals and that this was part of life. This is part of how the system works, and it was a deeper relationship.
Yeah.
That was my analysis.
Yeah, I think it was no less a relationship. And I think that the comparison with cannibalism is fitting, too, because the reason that it is disrespectful to kill a pig and let it rot and not eat its food, not eat its flesh, whereas it would be cannibalism to let a human die and eat their flesh, is that the pigs and the humans are different. And not just because of humans, but I think pigs have... and all livestock have a pretty unique understanding of their place. I think they kind of know who they are, which is a strange thing. But it's all throughout traditional methods of animal sacrifice and harvesting, halal kosher traditions. It's understood that the animal is submitting to something willfully. It's submitting, it's sacrificing. So it elevates its death to the level of a sacrifice. It's not just an expiration. It's not just, you know, in a modern world, a mechanized transition from living to dead, you know, a biological, something that's simple and biological and that can, it comes into a building live and then gets spit out the other end, wrapped for the supermarket. And you don't realize that connection until you do raise it on a small scale. And you actually develop a relationship with the animal and then harvest it for its flesh.
So in your videos, and we're going to get to this video in a moment, I remember one of the points I thought is that you show quartering, and which I always kind of thought was a silly word because you're going to quarter a half.
Right.
And so you take a half a pig and you break it into four pieces, so it's like you're going to quarter, so the pig itself must be worth at least two.
Yeah.
Probably about 2.8 if you count all the innards. Yeah. And then you're gonna end up with four quarters and the innards and the head.
Yeah, so you're kind of aping. Yeah, yeah, and I think it's just because most the form that the pig comes in to the butcher shop is in sides of pork.
Right.
So you start with a side, and then physiologically you divide it into quarters, and those quarters are informed by the physiology of the pig. There's the shoulder because it does shoulder things, and then there's the loin because it does loin things in terms of movement, you know, and how many heavy bones each muscle articulates. And those muscles are grouped in quarters, basically.
Now, when they quartered it in the video that we just watched, the DVD, yeah, they quartered it slightly differently.
Totally different.
Totally different.
Totally different, yeah. And it's just, it's British. Butchery serves cookery, period. And they cook different than we cook here. And that is the case all over the world. So every region has a different way to butcher. The physiology of the pig still informs much of it. Particularly, you know, even in the way that they butchered, they were still separating muscles that had similar functions. You know, the muscles that were bearing the weight of the head and the front leg and doing all of the heavy lifting are therefore tough. They still separated those from the muscles that are tender, like the loin, that they cooked all in one big, beautiful porchetta type of roast. So I think that there's a infinite variation, and it's all regional, because everybody cooks differently, and everybody eats differently. And the only reason that our knowledge of butchery, consequently, the only reason that our knowledge of butchery and our exposure to it, and our knowledge of livestock physiology has been totally erased from the consumer's mind is because the way we cook has changed. And we don't really like to know about these processes, you know, the earlier steps that turn the pig into pork.
So a lot of people will avoid ever eating a hot dog because they believe that what's in the hot dog is inferior cuts of meat. Now you don't make, we didn't see him making hot dogs in this video, nor did you make hot dogs in your video, but you know, basically a hot dog is another form of, we're going to take some of these bits and we're going to massage them into tube steaks, and it's possible that you could make a hot dog out of rat parts, but I don't think that that's what's really going on. It's an efficient use of some of the bits of the animal that didn't end up being big pieces or that are recognized as the pork chop and the bacon.
There are no inferior cuts. You know, there are no off cuts. There's no waste. And I think that the hot dog is a great example of that. The problem with the hot dog is that it happens on the industrial scale. So it's like slaughter floor slurry. You know, it's actually filthy. And it's from pigs that are not healthy, that are sick. Therefore, what's going into it is sick. But the idea of using the slaughterhouses, even industrially, are incredibly efficient. Nothing is wasted. It's put to lesser ends than those parts deserve. But to take, you know, what is the thing, you know, lips, tongues, and assholes and put them into hot dogs might be kind of gross, but, you know, if it's from a healthy pig, it's not that bad. That's
good
stuff.
I'm thinking that that the hot dogs that, I mean, I could go out and I can, I believe that if I would go out right now and I go to, we're in the Seattle area, we're on Vashon Island near Seattle, so here it would be the Whole Foods. I can go to the Whole Foods store, and I can pick up a package of organic hot dogs. I'd be willing to put money to say that the meat that's used in there is not coming off of the floor. Are you agreeing with my guess?
Yeah, I don't think that they would do that, particularly for the requirements of organic certification. And in the case of Whole Foods, they do tend to, they have some pretty explicit rules that they follow in terms of how they determine their sourcing.
So I think that it is entirely plausible and possible, maybe even probable, that if you go to Safeway and you buy the cheapest package of hot dogs, it may have come off of the floor.
Yeah,
and it may have been, it may have a high quantity of rat bits, and it might be, like it might turn to be something you don't really want to know.
Yeah.
And then there's extra chemicals put in there, not only to make it last, have a long shelf life, but also extra chemicals to compensate for the rats.
Toxicity. Yeah, and it might be the result, not necessarily of filth, but of over-cleanliness, which is just as detrimental to your health than filth.
Oh, I want to hear more about that.
So, you know, the slurry house floor is probably bleached every day. You know, maybe
right.
It's bleached every 4 hours. Maybe there is not a single strand of bacteria in the whole place because it's sanitized on a regular basis. Therefore, you could eat off the floor. It's totally clean. But there's something different in the sense that there is no art or culinary tradition informing the processing at all. It's overly sanitized meat. It is a living animal that has been reduced to something that is not living, and we've forgotten the sapient capacity of the animal. It is an ingredient. And therefore, you can only raise the taste to a certain level. It's impoverished because of its origins. The bottom line. Flavor means nothing. And therefore, the health of the animals, the happiness of the animals, or the artfulness with which they are killed or dispatched and processed are all irrelevant considerations. And the goal is to produce something that is cheap and that fits the way that people cook today, which is to cook without having to think about cooking.
Do you guys have anything to add yet? Am I just dominating everything?
That's okay. Keep rolling. There's a lot to cover.
Okay. All right, there is a lot to cover. Okay. I do think lately I've been getting a lot of people who've been for some reason my video about washing dishes by hand versus using a dishwasher has been getting a lot of attention. I don't know where it's coming from. And so we're getting the people coming back and saying like, "Oh, how can you wash dishes by hand? Those aren't going to be sterile." Mm-hmm. And my response has always been like, "I don't want it to be sterile. I want it to be clean." Mm-hmm. And I suspect that 20 to 30 years into the future, people will be required to own a dishwasher. Under law, you will be required by law to own a dishwasher, because then fear will be used. Fear will be told, if you don't, how are you going to get your stuff sterile? And it's kind of like goes back to, how are we able to reproduce to the point that we are now without dishwashers then? Much like bleach was not a common thing for a long time. And so I do think that there's something about, you start going down this path, that path of the sterility is that which is going to make us sicker. I think sterility is good in certain situations, but I think for day-to-day living, sterility is a really bad idea.
Well, I was commenting, some of the meat in the video showed that it did get a mold bloom on it, and they said that's normal, that's fine, you just cut that off, and there's the salami or the prosciutto underneath. It's fabulous.
It had to be the right kind of mold.
Right. Well, and I noticed that the meat you have hanging in your kitchen, mm-hmm. You had coated the cut ends with fat. Mm-hmm. And you said something about you wanted the bacteria to be doing something, and mm-hmm. the fat helped it. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to butcher what you said. Huh?
Yeah, I think that's the best thing about this video produced by the River Cottage people. Is that they are butchering outdoors in the open air without gloves on, without white aprons on, with no bleach bucket, on wood. They never mention sanitation, not once. And the result is incredibly empowering because the sanitation rhetoric is completely based on fear, which is crippling. And you're never going to make a salami if the first sentence to the recipe is, you could die doing this, ... Now go make sausage, which is how all American charcuterie books are written. This totally breaks the mold, which I think is so encouraging and so empowering, that you can actually just make salami and it will work and it won't kill you. Not only that, it'll be more delicious than anything that is produced, particularly in this country. If you make the salami the way he does, and you dry it properly and it turns out to taste good, you will have a product that does not exist in America. It is impossible to produce salami this way for retail in the United States. So impossible.
Now, it was my impression that as we're watching this, that there was like a lot of things that came up, and while Richard was shying away from the brains, you were like grooving on, like, see that right there? See what he just said? And that there were like all these, so these guys in this DVD, these are masters. These are not hacks who just cobble together something. These guys are, you believe, I'm guessing, maybe I should leave it up to you to say, oh, what do you think of this DVD?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's wonderful. I think it is empowering at its core. And for that reason, it is infinitely valuable. I think that Hugh, he's got more of a chef background, and I think his whole thing is that he kind of presents himself as a hack, in the context of his videos, because he's kind of the character that's learning, And then he finds these local professionals like Ray, who is the butcher and who's been a butcher for decades, and the tradition of small-scale butcher shops actually still exists in Britain, and we almost don't have it here at all. At the supermarket, they haven't been butchering whole carcasses since 1983 or 1986. So those butchers don't know how to quarter.
Right. They just get in the shiny packages and put them on the shelves.
The slaughterhouse has done all the butchery for them. So there's no butchers around anymore. So you lose this wealth of knowledge that this butcher has from working in his own small shop, getting whole carcasses, telling you how to cook things. You know, he's a culinary expert also. And there is a traditional professionalism that is so rich that we just don't have. And I think that's hugely valuable and what I value this kind of production for.
So we missed little parts of the DVD because excitement kept happening. And it's like I remember at one point in time you were saying something about, like, notice how they just, you know, made this sausage or whatever it was they did, and it's like they didn't use any nitrates. There's all the ingredients. We watched all the ingredients go in. They listed them off, and you were making it a point, look, they didn't use any nitrates. Did you notice that? Did you see that? You probably didn't notice that.
Yeah.
I'm pointing it out now. And then later in the video, after doing this several times, look! Then it's like they whipped out a little bowl and they said, this is saltpeter. Ah, there it is. That's the nitrates. And they've got a little bowl. Is it going in? Is it going in? And they were talking about it.
Yeah.
And they're talking about how most people have, like, this is an important thing. You gotta put it in there. It's an important thing. And then he turns to Hugh turns to Ray and says, do you want to put them in?
Mm.
And Ray said, I don't want to.
Yeah.
I'm not going to. So they kind of skipped ahead, but it did seem like they were saying, like, and we're not going to put any in.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have a background in English literature, so I love British culture. And I love the way that Ray answers that question. He says something to the effect of, not for me personally. Which is so British. It's more American to say, no, nitrates are evil. What are you saying? We are not putting this in here. You know, to an end the conversation.
I put a cap in your ass.
Yeah, right. It's so, we like to be authoritative and overconfident and overbold. But the British culture is much more about conversation. That's why they end a lot of declarative sentences in questions and statements. They'll say, isn't it? You know, because they want to keep the dialogue going. It's more about a conversation and less about bringing down the law, which we tend to like to do, particularly when it comes to nitrates. And his perspective is actually more appropriate, you know, not for me personally. I'm not going to do the nitrates. Because then you actually want to ask, oh, well, why? But when someone just says, no, it's bad for you, you're like, oh, okay, well, you're
an asshole. Then if I question them, then I'm going to catch a world of hurt.
And you're not going to get any knowledge or information, which is essential to all of this, is that in order to counter the culture of fear that surrounds the processing of meat and curing meat in America, you have to have knowledge. You know, knowledge is the opposite of fear. It empowers you. And if you actually know what nitrates are, rather than bleach the hell out of everything and overuse nitrates and salt, you will actually be more empowered. You'll be more informed. You'll be more accurate. And the saltpeter that they're using that is nitrate. It's potassium nitrate, and it's been used for a long time. It's very old. Something that you would get at the chemist in Europe to make your salamis. And
to make gunpowder.
And to make gunpowder, right.
And boom, baby.
It actually is, it's purely a flavoring thing. It doesn't really actually solidly prevent botulism, which is the whole point for that's the core of the whole nitrite discussion. Nitrate was mostly used because it imparted a pleasing color, and people liked the taste, the tanginess that it created. It needs to be converted into nitrite in order to prevent botulism, in order to, you know, ensure that botulism, that Clostridium botulinum will not create the botulism toxin. And the only way it can go from nitrate to nitrite is if Staphylococcus and Micrococcus bacteria are present in the meat. So the meat has to actually be of good provenance. It has to be a healthy pig, because it has to have a lot of myoglobin and color in its meat for the nitrate to even do anything. so we have devolved to such a horrific level in American charcuterie that we don't even bother with the nitrate anymore because our meat is so pathetic and of poor quality. We have to inject the nitrate because there's nothing in the meat to convert it to actually prevent what might be botulism. But they don't even get into that. It's all they just say make salami and salt it properly, which is brilliant because it works. One of the ways you inhibit nitrate, botulism, is by creating an acidic environment. And when you salt your salami mixture, and they emphasize this, 2.2% salt by weight, it encourages the lactic bacteria fermentation. Salami is actually all about encouraging bacteria. And that lactic bacteria creates lactic acid by eating the sugars that are in the meat. And that acidity is very inhospitable to Clostridium botulinum, and they usually don't proliferate in that kind of environment. So the opposite of what we tend to think is true. You don't want to make salami in an overly sanitized environment. The meat itself is almost sanitary, the flesh. You have to introduce the fermenting bacteria to it with your bare hands, with your butcher block, and with the knife that you're using to cut it, and through the meat grinder, because the meat's pretty sanitary. It's innocuous. It's not going to go anywhere but spoil. So you have to introduce bacteria to it for it to ferment, because if salami doesn't ferment, it's going to rot. It's not going to go good. It's going to go bad. And that is all assumed in this whole video. It's the whole approach. Just the fact that they're using wood is totally porous. You could not use wood as a cutting surface in any production scenario in America. And so what I like to do in my shop is I clean my tools with food because I'm not trying to create a sanitary environment. I want to ferment my butcher's block. So I clean it with brine. I clean it with salt water. I scrub it, and I allow it to actually become penetrated with salt to encourage the proper bacteria and to hinder the bad stuff. And it works perfectly, because sanitization, in a sense, is ultimately a myth. You can't kill all the bacteria.
Right.
They're just going to keep morphing on you into stronger and stronger strains. It's a losing battle.
You're going to have the speediest bacteria infest your kitchen.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Whoever shows up the fastest and reproduces the fastest with whatever's there.
Yeah, right.
So now, while we're talking about nitrates and nitrites, just a real quick thing, celery juice.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've heard some people say that, oh, yes, one organic technique is to use celery juice instead of the nitrates and nitrites. And then what you've done is that you've just replaced one unit of nitrate with 10 units of nitrate. Mm-hmm. So for those people who get headaches from the nitrates, such as myself,
mm-hmm.
then you're going to probably get a 10 times bigger headache
mm-hmm.
from using the naturally occurring nitrates.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like you've gone from a chemical to a natural source, but the natural source turns out to be even worse than the chemical.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is what I've heard. I'd like to hear if that was a load of shit or if that was accurate.
Yeah, I haven't used celery salts, but I tend to go back to tradition. I believe in the democracy of the dead, in that people had good ideas and they did things pretty well for a while. And so
now they've mysteriously survived to reproduce and make us.
Right. And I think, so I like to go back to tradition to be informed as to, well, how did they prevent botulism? You know, because I know they did, because they didn't all die, because we're here. And celery salt, I have no idea where that comes from. I feel like that was, you know, more of a food scientist saying, oh, look, there's a lot of nitrate in celery. Let's use that as an additive in sausage, but really...
Sucker the organic people.
Right, yeah.
But
if you actually, you know, you start with the presupposition that nitrate is neither good nor bad, but thinking makes it so. It's, you know, it's a natural thing. It's a natural occurring impurity in a lot of mineral salts. So Himalayan pink salt has nitrate in it. And when the old charcutiers, you know, back in the day, were getting their salts from mines, or even sea salt has a little bit of traces of nitrate in it. These were naturally occurring impurities in the salt. And so when you have overly refined salt, you eliminate all of the other minerals that are there, reducing all of the food for the fermenting bacteria too, because bacteria needs minerals. So they would, you know, one butcher shops could be separated by, you know, a couple hundred yards and source their salt differently, and they could follow the same exact recipe for salami and come up with completely different end products, because not only of the different levels of nitrate in the salt that they're using, but the flora in their butcher shop that affects the fermentation of the salami and the flora that grows on their hands. I mean, you talk to old charcutiers and they're like, yeah, I never mix my salami with gloves on because it won't taste the same. I have to use my bare hands because that's how I introduce the bacteria. It's on my hands.
So now this is like the third or fourth time you've said this, and these moments that you've been talking are the first I've ever considered the idea that meat like ham or salami is a fermented food.
Yes, salami is definitely fermented. Ham, prosciutto, or bacon, things that are dry cured, might have undergone a little bit of fermentation, but it'd be very minimal. It's more or less incidental to the actual curing and preservation of the product. Prosciutto, bacon, and I guess we have to define all of those things. Meat that you salt, rinse the salt off, and then hang it in your kitchen, and it keeps indefinitely hanging in indoor temperatures. That's cured. That's been cured. That is what prosciutto is. It's been salted for a couple weeks, rinsed, dried, and hung for 2 years or 8 months or whatever, depending on the region and the relative humidity. Those things, whole muscle cures, they are preserved because they've dried out. They're pork jerky. What happens when you cure meat from beef, generally, is that it becomes jerky. When you cure meat from pork, it becomes prosciutto. Pork is very special because of its fat content and the polyunsaturated fat and the ratio of saturated fat and the bacterial makeup of the meat, and the structure of the meat, I should say, the proteins. It creates a different flavor altogether. And the quantity of fat allows this completely dry product to actually be juicy and succulent when it's done. Where was I going with that? Salami, however, is absolutely fermented because you are grinding it. You are multiplying the surface area of the meat. So you're introducing ambient bacteria in your grinder, on your hands, on your butcher block, on your knife, to every square millimeter of meat. And so that is definitely, undoubtedly, a fermentation. Like, when you hang up a salami, after it hangs for a couple days, it'll smell pickled. You'll be able to recognize the lactic acid smell. It'll smell like a pickle jar, because that's what's happening inside, because you've introduced the bacteria.
So if somebody's got, if they're doing all their cutting on some sort of sterile surface, and they're wearing gloves and whatever else, then it's there's a good chance their salami won't work. It'll turn into something scary.
Right. And all of the American salami-making recipes and all the books that are produced in this country, they compensate for that because they know that's the case. You're going to buy insipid pork at a supermarket or something, and you're going to... They instruct you to partially freeze all of your equipment, freeze your grinder, partially freeze the meat, otherwise it turns to mush when you put it through the grinder because the meat is of such low quality. All of this, you know, they ground their meat outside in this video, which is just such an awesome testament to the quality of the pork that he's raising. Poor quality pork comes out as paste from a grinder. It comes out in little structured worms, you know, through the plate. It's good quality stuff. So they instruct you to sanitize everything, and then you have to reintroduce bacteria. So you have to buy lactic bacteria powders. You have to buy acidophilus and add it to the mixture because it's not in the flesh on its own. It might be in very small amounts, but it's mostly bacteria. And you're not introducing it through your tools or your cutting surface, so you actually have to add it.
Wow. So... When you wash your block with some sort of salty, briny kind of thing,
then basically your block becomes the place, the source, the mother of a lot of this. And then, of course, you know, your hand will touch the block, and the meat itself will touch the block, and the knives will touch the block.
Right.
And so then it, basically your block becomes the mother for all of the bacteria that you need to do the things that you're doing.
Right.
Fascinating. Okay, that's something I never knew and is not mentioned in your videos, nor is it mentioned in the video that we just watched. But now that I know that, it's like I want to go watch the videos again to see that. Like, not like I'm going to see the bacteria, like, leaping off of the block and into the meat. Whee! And now we're going to reproduce. No, okay. Awesome. That is amazing. I made a list of things that I thought were noteworthy as we were watching this, and now I regret that I did not make a list last night as we watched your three videos. But
I do think his videos showed the quartering and showed exactly where to cut between this rib and this bone and this. The filming was up above a lot of times. It was very clear, and they used diagrams, and they repeated, which the repeating really, really helps.
Okay.
The pig in the day video, he said at the very beginning he was trying to cram so much. It was everything from getting the piglets to training the piglets to harvesting them and cooking the meat, you know, as with the butchery kind of sandwiched in the middle, that he didn't have a lot of time to really cull out the actual butchery of it. So I loved how your videos did.
I need to confess that when I, although I've raised a lot of hogs, that nearly all the hogs were harvested by the mobile, you know, they call it mobile butcher or whatever. But really all they would do is pop them in the head. And neither video showed that, by the way, the actual kill, which I think is kind of important. It's a little...
This came the closest.
Yeah. In your video, you had the gun kind of hovering there, and it was a .22, and you were saying in the video that it was the idea was to stun. And the important thing is that it's like the center of the forehead, but a little to the right. And so I've always seen a little to the right. I've always kind of gotten the impression a little to the right is important. But I imagine if you went a little to the left, that would probably work too.
Yes.
But I always think it's a little to the right, like an inch to the right of dead center. And there's a way to, you know, mentally draw an X and stuff like that. And in your video, you were saying that a lot of it was be patient. Wait for, you don't want to botch this shot. And I do remember that when the guys came and then they would harvest our hogs, that they did, I was amazed, first shot every time.
Good.
And you know, our pigs, we had them trained to like, it's time for candy.
Yeah.
Yay, candy, I love candy, I love candy. And they'd come running, and then you always get down to just one. Only one's going to eat the candy, and then a .22 makes a very light pop, so it's just a little pop, and then they're done, and then you get the candy back, and you can use it for the next pig.
Because then
they open them up, and they would take the skin off, and we kept everything to just feed to the chickens. So all the stuff that they were, like, chucking, we would use just as a simple feedback to the chickens thing. But you did not.
Right.
And these guys did not. You left the skin on, they left it. And then that's where you would get the hot water on the critter and then scrape them.
Yeah.
And they didn't, I think yours showed a little bit of scraping, not very much.
Just here's
3 seconds on scraping.
Right.
And then you're moving on.
Yeah.
This video didn't. But I'm trying to wrap up my experience here. So I saw a lot of hogs leave that way. And then it was about a year ago that a couple of chefs from Portland came to Missoula, and they were offering basically a butchering class. So myself and one other student, we got our own half a hog to quarter, and then after we quartered it, then we started whittling and smaller things. And there was one thing that we did that I didn't see in either of these videos, and that was that if we wanted to, and I did this because I thought this seemed good to me, but I was probably wrong,
And that is like you could take the butcher knife, you know, which is the big blocky one. Is there a better word for it?
The steak knife.
Not the steak knife, the bigger one, the heavier one.
Oh, the cleaver.
The cleaver. You would take the cleaver, and rather than try and whack down on a hunk of bone and potentially miss, which I seem to be my habit was to miss, is that basically you could take a wooden mallet, so you hold the cleaver in place and then whack the top of the cleaver.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed to be my technique, and being a massive guy, that worked out well for me. But because I was always worried that if you take a saw, then you get like bone grit, and the idea of bone grit kind of, you know, gave me the willies. But you know, what do I know? That was my first time ever butchering a hog. So anyway, that's the limit of my experience. I'm very new to this, and I'm not a cook, so there's a lot I don't know. I'm an ignorant boob. But okay, but at the same time, watching the stuff last night and today has been awesome. The list. So off of my list, the first item on my list is that in Britain, in England, it's not legal to harvest your own hog. Was that what they said?
Yeah, I think he clarified it a little later on that the EU laws say that you cannot harvest your own hog and then sell any of it or even barter with it.
Which is kind of similar to what they have here.
Which is what we have here, yeah. I don't know if they've actually explicitly legislate bartering. It seems kind of insane to me because that's not... Maybe that is interstate commerce. I don't know. But, yeah, I think that's how he clarified it.
Okay, because I know that here, if you want to, you can harvest your own hog.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're going to eat it yourself.
Right.
And I kind of was thinking that's probably what he was going to do.
Yeah.
Because he started off at the beginning of the video raising two hogs, much the same way that you talk about in your video. And so these were his hogs. Mm-hmm. And then harvest day came, and then the hogs went away. And it seemed like he would want to be doing that part. But it kind of seemed like it was being pressed to him that, no, you're not allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I suppose if his whole thing is that, and I want to sell the meat to people, then it's like, yeah, you're not allowed to.
Yeah.
You know, I think, yeah, I'm not even sure. I think that I had to have somebody kill my hogs in order to be able to. I could either sell the hogs whole or the mobile service would come.
Mm-hmm. Well, the question I had about that is because he was paying an abattoir, but they took the pigs from his property off to the butcher shop to dispatch them at the butcher shop.
Mm-hmm.
And what you were describing is they dispatched them at your farm,
right,
and they didn't have to travel anywhere. And I was just wondering, you know, how much adrenaline is going to go into that meat on that trip to where they would get dispatched, and how much would that affect the quality of meat? I was wondering if you had comments on that.
Well, the worst-case scenario is you get that pale, soft, exudative effect, which the pig releases so much lactic acid into its muscles, I think it is, because of stress, that it actually turns its skeletal muscle into like a paste. It's totally inedible. And what happened around the hip bone is terrible. And I think that takes a huge amount of stress to create that. The pigs that he was doing here in this video were not going to be anywhere near that. If you've ever tried to load pigs into a trailer, you know it is a huge, huge, really difficult task. But it's a great idea, he created a channel that was narrower than the pigs are long, so they couldn't turn around in it. And you just walk behind them with boards all the way up into the trailer, which is the only way, because pigs don't herd, you know. They go as many as directions as there are pigs, unless there's just one place they can go, and they're not being stressed and they're not being pushed, they're just being cajoled into an area, they'll do it. So I think the key there is transportation is not a terrible thing. If it's your only option, it can be done well, you know. it can be done well.
I think that the approach that I've always used that worked well, and I saw them do a little bit of it in the video that we watched today, and that is that candy, and this is I always felt it was good when feeding each animal the candy, mm-hmm. that to have a different call that would go with them that they would associate with candy. So I always did pig, pig, pig. And so whenever I made the sound pig, 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 the pigs were like running, like you know, we've got Pavlov's dog thing going on here. They run. This is, otherwise they might miss out because mm-hmm. the other pigs will eat all the candy before they get there. Mm-hmm. So they've got it pretty well. Same thing with chickens, chick, 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 and they all run. So you know, it's the same kind of thing. So. When getting animals to go up into a trailer for whatever reason, you got the candy and you say the magic words, pig, 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 and then it's like they're in the trailer, now I get my candy, give me now.
Yeah, pigs won't be chased, but they can follow.
Yeah. All right. I saw them drying meat, so they had meat hanging, and it was in a sunny cupboard. It's like in his kitchen. Yeah. There was a whole bunch of sun, and I was kind of thinking to myself, like, well, it'll get kind of warm in there at times, and it'll be hotsy-coldsy,
mm-hmm.
and at the same time, if UV hits on there, which I think it kind of doesn't because mm-hmm. glass kind of filters UV, but some UV will get on it, and that would be a sterilizing-ish thing on the outside. I'm not sure if that's what we're shooting for. I just have never seen... a glass cupboard. It was glass to the outside as well as glass to the inside.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah, and I think the only thing that sometimes light can cause the fat to go a little rancid. It'll yellow the fat a little bit, which I guess is also a result of oxidation. And the amount of polyunsaturated fat in there, which again, it all goes back to the quality of the pork. Everything comes back to the quality of the pig. If the pig is happy and has lived a piggish life in the sense that it has eaten what its body is designed to eat, then it will put on a lot more saturated than polyunsaturated fat. And saturated fat keeps much better. It won't yellow as quickly. So it's more stable in that kind of environment that he had it in. But if you hung a supermarket pork in there, it would just spoil. It would turn completely yellow. I thought that was interesting. His thick stone walls, I think, would also provide some cooling. You know, those were really, they were like almost 2 feet thick and then windows on either side. The other advantage of that kind of scenario would be it would get a little warm in there, but warmer air can hold more water, so it could be a little more humid. And there is a fine line between too humid and just right with pork that's hanging, dry curing pork. Basically, you want to slow down the drying as much as possible, particularly with salami. You want it to be right on the edge of spoilage the whole time, but not spoiling, because that creates the most flavor. That the lactic bacteria and the acid that's created by it, as well as the absence of water through the drying process, kills not only pathogens and spoilage bacteria, but flavor-producing bacteria. And so it's a fine line. You know, if you want to really take it to the most artsy level, you don't have to worry about it when you're doing it in your house. I think it's a skill that you develop later on. But I think in that little air cubby that he had it would be pretty humid. Salami, ideally, is about 80% humidity. That's incredibly humid.
Yeah.
That's like fog on the glass. That's really humid.
That might be difficult to do in Montana. And one of the things out of this movie that was not in your movie was that a lot of emphasis was put on people going crunch, 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 crunch. Yes, this is really crackling good. And it seemed like and it was universally. The skin. They always wanted to leave a bit of skin on there, mm-hmm. and to them that seemed to be one of their most favorite parts, was to get that skin to cook in a certain way, then they could go and peel off bits of it and crunch it.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time they did that is they put a pig on a spit.
Yeah.
And then as they're doing that, then you said that this is one of the services that you provide. And maybe we haven't talked enough about, oh, hey, Brandon, so there's more to you than just making these three videos that we watched last night.
Yeah, so we are Farmstead Meatsmith, and our website is farmsteadmeatsmith.com. And we provide the services of on-farm, on-site slaughter and butchery and charcuterie. Basically, we'll drive to a farm and do all of those things, even over a period of a few days. And the unique thing about us is that we do it all traditional. You know, I've never skinned a pig. I can't bring myself to do it because of the crunchy skin.
And, because of the crunchy.
Yeah, and because it's terribly wasteful. I mean, it's like 20% of the weight of the carcass. It's unbelievable. And because pigs have skins and not hides, there's no seam between skin and fat, skin and flesh. They have skin like us. And so when you skin a pig, you automatically remove most of the back fat, which is unforgivable because that is the most unique fat in the, you know, cornucopia of livestock that we eat is on the back of a pig, right under the skin. It's the densest fat. It's the only fat that stays the large white chunks in salami. It doesn't turn into mush. But anyway, there's a million other reasons. So our whole approach is traditional. And from the cutlery to the we use and the way we cut a pig to the way we ferment and cure and dry pork with people. We also offer instruction. So we will frequently have a farmer solicit our services to harvest a pig, and then we'll offer to turn it into a public or private class and invite people to spend a whole day doing pork harvesting, or lamb, or goat, or chicken. We've done a bunch of them. We do about 3 to 6 a month or more during the busy season, which is fall and winter. And these are hands-on classes. So I put the knife in people's hands and walk them through every step. So we take our time, and we'll spend a whole day on slaughter, a whole day on butchery, and a whole day on curing. And they take about 6 hours or so. We'll break for lunch, and they're awesome. It's as much of a remembering. I feel like an archaeologist. It's more just uncovering what people already know. And if you give people the right tools, you suddenly find that they kind of already have a good idea of how a side of pork should be butchered. You just have to give them the right tools, and then you can kind of point out a few things. And it's amazing what you know when you hold a cleaver, you know. We tend to think of ourselves as very culinarily ignorant, especially ignorant about butchery and charcuterie, but it's a basic knowledge. It's peasant wisdom, you know. It's not industrial specialized knowledge.
So you said you have a spit out back, and that this, you know, pig on a spit is a thing that you've done many, many times.
Yeah, we also roast animals for people, and we have a manual iron spit that we got to turn manually and turn the meat by quarters, and we roast pigs, mostly on the spit, but I've roasted 2 lambs on it, or a string of chickens, whatever. And we do it, we start with hard wood, so we don't roast over, you know, pre-bought charcoal. We make all of our own embers, and we cook on those, because it's the best. And we also do kind of in the style of Cordero al Asador, where we cook lambs and goats butterfly on a cross, leaning over fire. Which is incredibly delicious. And yeah, we've done that for weddings and corporate parties and birthdays and everything.
So as part of the video that we watched today, they had something that was not in your video, and that's where they trained their pig in a way, and it seemed like this is so not going to work, and yet it totally did. And they went out and they found truffles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty cool. I love that. He really does everything he possibly can with the pig, from finding truffles to showing it at local, like our equivalent of 4-H, you know.
Yeah.
It's so cool.
And the whole thing about moving a pig, I've never moved a pig that way.
Yeah, with a board and a cane. It's a very specific way, which that would be a great thing to figure out when you need to move your pigs. What a useful skill. Yeah, and it's unfortunate. I think in America, I don't know if it exists in Britain, but here there's a divide. There's the 4-H mentality of raising animals, and then there's, you know, us hippies over here raising them beautifully and conscientiously for food. and they're very different, you know, totally different.
Well, and the factories.
And the factories, right. And so it would be a hurdle to, you know, jump that divide to get into 4-H. But I think we totally need to. I think it's awesome. I think people need to get together around it, regardless of their political or ideological differences, and because we need to revolutionize the way animals are graded and judged, because it's wrong. It's just dead wrong now. You know, they're all lean and not healthy. But if we could bring our fat lard pigs that have been pasturing and kind of get some proper definition back to what defines a good pig, I think that's a worthwhile pursuit.
Well, and I'm a powerful advocate of different techniques for raising pigs. And there were a lot of things I saw in this video today that I liked. And there were a few things where it kind of made me a little queasy.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'd like to go and pop over there and visit with the guy a little bit and say, a pig is a forest animal. And so I'd very much like the idea. I think having them have access to pasture is great, but making sure they always have access to forest is essential.
Yeah.
But, you know, maybe that was going on. I couldn't see it. But I kept seeing areas where it was really dug up a lot, and I was kind of thinking, like, I'd kind of rather not see that.
Right.
I do think in the wintertime you end up with some sacrifice areas.
Yeah.
And so maybe that – so I was trying to tell myself that must be what's going on,
yeah,
because this guy does seem so cool in so many ways. Surely – I'm not, you know, the camera's not showing me everything.
Right.
And so I'm going to pretend that's what it is.
Yeah.
It's the camera not showing me everything. But he did talk about the animals could get sunburned.
Yeah.
And I kind of think, well, when they've got a good thick forest,
yeah,
they won't.
Yeah, that's funny because I noticed the same thing, but I had almost a different reaction. I was kind of happy because my whole business, I only work with small producers, what he calls small producers. We don't really have that term in America, but small holdings.
Mm-hmm.
Two or three pigs, you know, a year, and that's about it. And those are the people that I work with. And these people are not wealthy. They don't have a ton of land. They have limited resources. They don't have forest anywhere, but they really want pigs. So does that mean they shouldn't raise them because they don't have forest? And I liked that he kind of didn't try to present this perfect picture of pastured pork, and it's absolutely perfect because it's not entirely reality in my experience. Though it is, I totally agree with you, you know, pigs ideally need to be in undergrowth. At the same time, I think an equally essential part of a pig's nature as a livestock domesticated animal is that it is malleable, and it will do what you ask of it. It's this amazing quality that pigs have. And they, if you treat them well, they can thrive and actually be healthy in some pretty small spaces. And this is just speaking from what I've experienced. You know, I've seen pigs on pasture that I thought were very unhealthy, because in partial forest too, because they have a huge parasite load and they are skinny and there's too much mud. They haven't been managing the pasture well, or even without the mud, you know, they're just not thriving. Maybe because they're not getting enough grain, they're getting exclusively compost, and, you know, that might be kind of the ideal we have. And then I've seen people raise pigs in literally maybe a 16 by 20 foot concrete pad, and completely healthy, completely satisfied as pigs. They were had refreshed their entire bedding every day. This guy was meticulous. He treated them like dogs, and you know, which is a good
usually
division.
A phrase that means you're treated poorly.
I know, isn't that funny? Yeah. So if we could blur the line between pets and livestock, I think that's part of what needs to happen in our ideology. But they had bedding every day, you know, and if I had to choose between a pig in mud, pasture, you know, which some people call pasture, it's actually just mud, or a pig on concrete with straw bedding, the straw is better. And he was cleaning it out every day. He would sit with the pigs every day and interact with them. They were huge because they didn't get a ton of exercise, you know, they weren't doing the sprinting. But they were fed organically, really good food, and they were thriving. They got huge in like 5 months. And
You know, they had good color. They had good, I think one really quick test of whether a pig is thriving is obviously how attracted it is to food, but it's agility. You know, a pig is always moving. They almost should never stop moving unless they're just kind of sleeping or resting. But their head is always totally alert. They're always on the lookout. And the first sign that a pig is starting to go downhill is when they get lethargic and their movements become slow. And these pigs were, they were in the prime of health.
Lively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When one of the things that I saw that I really didn't like in this movie was barbed wire. Mm. And so maybe I'm the only one who's like really objects to barbed wire. I grew up building I don't know how many barbed wire fences and taking some down because they were rusty and cattle were cutting themselves and getting sick and stuff.
Yeah.
But and on my farm, when we first bought the 80 acres in Spokane, went through the whole property and cleared out all the barbed wire first thing. But it was like months later that it turns out there was a spot where we must have missed some and a goat went through some brush or something and snagged on it, and she had a little kid that was, I don't know, all of like 2 weeks old, and so the mom's udder was ripped wide open, and it's like we could not get it to heal up, so we finally had to butcher the mom and then bottle feed the kid using, you know, goat milk from the other mamas, and so and then a horse like got caught up in barbed wire and just had like a football size chunk of meat taken out of its chest. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like, you know, I'm after these things, it's like I just can never do barbed wire again. Mm-hmm. And I'm a big fan of electric. I also think that for pigs, I mean, you can do things with wood and stone that are going to be great to keep pigs in. And I do think that there was a good mention, I'm not sure if it was in your video last night or in the thing we saw today, about like, you got to have a good fence, because especially when you got the opposite genders. And I think in these, yeah, in this podcast, if I mentioned the story of the gilts and we got the young boar, no. So I'm looking to Richard. So I had these two gilts that were probably about 6 months old, so they were just getting into the point where they were, like, ready to breed. Maybe they were 5 months old, 6 months old. And then I got a young boar as a weaner, and he was 6 weeks old. And so we put them probably about 300 feet apart in different areas, you know, with just cattle. Stock panels, mm-hmm, you know, using stock panels. And I think it took about a minute for the gilts to totally rip through the stock, which the gilts had been contained by stock panels for all time. Mm-hmm. And then we got this little boar in there, and the gilts just went through those stock panels in no time at all. Like, we've been just hanging out in here because mm-hmm, the food's good and we like it here. But now you got something over there that we want. And by want, we mean nothing's going to stop us. Mm-hmm. And so, and then they kept trying to flip that little, you know, get that little boar to mount. But he was too young and way too small. Mm-hmm. And so he had that poor guy. So we finally got them all separated again, but it was a lot of work.
Yeah.
And so I got to tell you, stock panel doesn't cut it,
no,
you know, in a situation like this. So, but I got the things are electric. Pigs really respect electric, but I've seen a lot of people do electric in a way that I think is really wrong. You never do a small area with electric. Never. That's just wrong. It's a psychological barrier. Now you're gonna. Okay, so I'm wandering off the topic a bit here. Barbed wire. I just did not like their use of barbed wire.
You'd rather have the electric for the sharp hot pop with the psychological barrier instead of something that could be more damaging.
Or a strong, heavy wood fence, mm-hmm, you know, and stone. A stone fence works good, too. But yeah, not barbed wire.
Was it Karen Biondo, was she here on Vashon, that had the
pallet
fence?
Yeah.
That she felt was strong enough for her pig.
Right. Got that. So, got a video about that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that fence design is smart. And she went through a lot of different.
You know.
She went through a lot of different designs of pallets until she came across that one.
Now, one thing I liked about the video, this is Richard, is that it almost looked like they did paddock shifting with the electric. Or they didn't call it paddock shift, but.
They said a couple things which made me think that maybe they're doing paddock shift, but it wasn't really clear. But, you know, that's not really what the video is really about.
Correct.
So I kind of let it go. But they did say something about don't run pigs more than 2 years on the same land because then they say the land will get pig sick.
Yeah.
That's the first I ever heard of that. But you know what? I think I could see a lot of truth to that. On the other hand, if you do paddock shift, I wonder if that would be not so true. I think that if you kept pigs on the same land for 2 years straight, I think if you kept pigs on the same land for 2 months straight, that land would be pig sick. I would think of it as, I could see it being called pig sick. But if you're doing a rotational system, a paddock shift system, I'm having a hard time seeing 2 years of paddock shift and the land being pig sick or, you know, getting a lot of parasite or disease buildup. So, but I could be wrong. Maybe they're onto something that I would really like to know more about.
Well, it seemed like in the he was just raising pigs. I didn't see. Well, you saw some geese at one point, but I think what Joel Salatin talks about is running the different animals through to help break the parasite cycles, especially the chickens to eat the different bugs and the. And claw through the manures and things like that. So that's what I thought of when he was talking about that. I thought, okay, what kind of rotation is happening? Are there other animal systems? Is it a really full ecosystem that could
or is it just one animal?
Yeah.
So before I get wandering down this too much, I got a note that you were talking about a moment, Brandon. The happier the pig, the tastier the ham. That was something that they said in today's video. Mm-hmm. So I think that's lined up. And then so back to, like, the barbed wire stuff, I got a note here about portable shelter. I don't think the shelters that they made were portable. I didn't like a lot of the shelters. I saw a lot of galvanized material, which I don't like to see, but I'm a little pickier about that than most. I'd like to see – I mean, the thing I've always built was a portable shelter, something that you can drag around with a tractor – or better, drag around with intern power. Interns, yeah, drag that shelter. Yeah, so, and then I thought, this is something that was in both of the videos, last night as well as today, it's like each of the chefs lines up their tools. And I believe that what you lined up, you had exactly four things.
Yeah.
But I imagine that there was at least one other thing that didn't show up there that was probably hidden. But you showed the bone saw, and then a large, but what you called a steak knife.
Yeah.
And I've always referred to it as scimitar.
Right.
So it's just another name for the same thing, which
kinda,
is
yeah.
kind of a thick bladed
scimitar
thing.
Has a specific shape, like a scimitar sword.
Right.
Mine has a bull nose.
Right, but the scimitar that I have is a little bit of both. It has a bull nose, and it kind of curves like that a little bit.
Yeah, that's cool.
So, and the only reason I own it is because for this butchering class a year ago, they said, here is what you must purchase before showing up to the class.
Huh.
And it's like, boy, I had to turn Missoula upside down to find one of these.
Yeah.
Then the bone knife, boning knife, which and then the cleaver. And those were, but then I imagine that one that you did not show would be some form of perpetually sharpening your blades.
Yeah. So I have a different philosophy than they do, than Ray does about sharpening blades. I used to work with a steel like he does, where you're constantly honing the edge on the steel every, you know, almost after every major session of cutting. And I prefer, I am way, way anal and finicky about scary sharp blades. I need my knives to be way sharper than shaving sharp. Cutting with a dull knife is utterly exhausting.
Which, at one point we saw in the video today, you were saying that guy's knife is dull.
Yeah, he was working with some pretty dull knives the whole time.
Okay.
And it didn't bother him, which is great. That's fine. But it's just a mental thing. It gets to me when I feel like I'm working against my primary tool all day. And I think, especially for people who are beginning, who are just starting out with butchery or who are going to try to bone out a shoulder for sausage or something, you will get quickly discouraged with a dull knife. Because, especially as a beginner, you have a vision in your head of how the day should go. You have a picture, this anticipation of how fun it's going to be to make sausage. And a dull knife will just completely wipe out that, because you'll go to cut, and it won't do what you have the picture of. It won't do what you're thinking, because it's dull. But a sharp knife will go exactly where you tell it to. It's much more satisfying.
I thought I was going to cut this, but instead of sort of smashing
it. Right, yeah. And if you're not staying on the line, and it just drives me nuts. So what I have done is I taught myself to sharpen knives. I bought a DVD. I tried to teach myself for 2 years how to sharpen knives totally without success. And then I broke down and bought a DVD from a guy that makes knives in Hillsboro, Oregon. CarterCutlery.com is the website. And he produced this. He's a bladesmith of endless credentials. You know, he makes like $4,000 knives. But he produced this How to Sharpen Knives DVD. And I think along with, pork and a cutting board and a knife, this knowing how to sharpen knives is the fourth tool. It's absolutely essential. And so I use Japanese water stones. And I don't hone my blades because the steel would just dull it instantly. Because I get them, I put very acute edges on my knives to where they're really scary sharp. And they stay sharp all day for me. I get them sharp enough to where I don't have to hone them constantly. They stay sharp all day. And then before every job, I resharpen them, you know.
Okay. Wow. That is an approach that this is the first I've heard of an approach like that.
Yeah.
And it's true. As we watched this video, I saw, like, oh, that's dull. And I do know that, like, if you're trying to do a deep cut do it in one swipe.
Right.
That wow, it's amazing. Like when you've got a sharp knife, it's like, I didn't know a knife could be that sharp and do that. Mm-hmm. And then when you've got a dull knife and you're like hacking at it, and it's like, I'm making the hamburger. Rasha, in the middle.
Yeah.
Then it's like, it's amazing what a sharp blade will do. Mm-hmm. So now I think we have to review another DVD. I have to get me one of those DVDs. So it seems like they had one more thing on their list. They had that sharpening. Oh, and then they had the mallet.
Yeah.
That they were saying, and they only whipped it out once, and they were like, okay, for this next maneuver, don't like beat the crap out of this.
Yeah.
This is just kind of going to massage it a little bit, you know, get it to lay a little flatter. That's all. It's already tender. We don't need to tenderize anymore with this big club.
Yeah.
So, but was there anything else? I think that was it.
Yeah.
It was still a very simple, basic tool set.
Yeah.
Yeah. The use of offal. And we kind of talked about this a little bit earlier with the hot dogs thing. I think in your video as well as this one, there's a lot of use of everything. Mm-hmm. I have to admit, I think I've eaten head cheese once. And I believe that the head cheese came from a company you may have heard of called Oscar Mayer. And I remember I didn't care for it.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe I need to try again with something that's a little bit better. But and then we saw a tongue, and my granddad seemed to always feed us tongue. And I remember a guy once saying, I didn't like the taste of tongue, and I think it didn't like the taste of me. So, I remember that we ate a lot of organ meat. We ate a lot of heart. We ate and then liver. A lot. Oh, geez, I did not like liver as a kid. Liver and onions. No, please, not that again.
So when my sister and her husband visited Poland and the Czech Republic, and they may have different names now in some of those areas. It was normal for them in those regions to spread lard on their bread. And you talk about that in some of your books, in your writings or in those movies. But you also talked about something that was new to me. That was the, was it Rillette?
Yeah, Riette. Yeah, which is, it's, I think Hugh would call it potted pork. Something that's potted. It's kind of a British term. But Riette is a French word for, it's basically the fatty scraps. The French take all the scraps and make, you know, the most decadent things in the universe from them. And one of them is Riette. And it's basically just the fatty scraps melted. You melt them really low and slow. And all the fat from the fatty scraps turns into liquid and braises the little bits of meat in it. And you do this until the meat is just spoonable, you know, it's coming apart. And you salt and pepper it and separate the liquid fat from the meat, the little strips of meat, and you put it in jars or in little clay pots. And you submerge the meat under an inch of the liquid fat. It's a method of preserving meat. And then you put it in the cellar or in the fridge, and it'll keep for several months. And it's basically a spread that you can dip in, a cold spread of salty, fatty pork. It's absurdly decadent. It's just salt and fat, basically. It's delicious.
So now if you were to open a jar, which it's not... it's not like you do a boiling water bath or anything like that. It's like, you know,
right.
You just take the lid off. It's not sealed in any way.
Right. Well,
and then you break the surface of the fat to get to the chunky bits below.
Mm-hmm.
How long does it last after you break the surface of the fat?
A long time, because even the chunky bits are surrounded by fat. And lard
and
is
salt.
And salt. And lard is incredibly stable, liquid fat. You know, when I render leaf lard from the pigs that we slaughter, I don't even refrigerate it. I keep it on my counter, and it keeps indefinitely. It just never goes bad. It would only go rancid if it's from a poor quality pig, but it stays really nice. It lasts for a long time, even after you've cracked into it. And it will, if you use mason jars, and you pour the liquid fat in on the top inch, and then you shut the jar, the seal will pop. Because as the fat cools, it'll suck, pop the seal. So it will actually be sealed.
Do you get it? You feel like it keeps longer that way?
I've always eaten them much too quickly to find out. Yeah.
That's the candy in the house.
It is, totally.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I kind of feel like for the use of offal, I'm a big advocate of having chickens and fish and all kinds of other critters that would eat the offal, and then on harvest day, then the offal goes to all the other critters that are of a totally different species.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, like pig intestines, do you use those?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in the South, that's what chitlins are. Basically, just spray them out with a hose, boil the hell out of them, and then deep fry them. They're pretty gnarly. That's what sausage casings are.
But gnarly can mean a lot of things. Could you expand on pretty gnarly?
Yeah. Well, you know, they don't clean out the pink mucosal inner lining, which is a saponification agent. You can make soap with that stuff. That is the essence of pigness. If you want to taste pig as pig, it's in the intestines. That's where the bacteria is that smells unmistakably of pig and nothing like beef, goat, or lamb. And the most common use of the intestines is for sausage casing, which is a really simple process, and we do it a lot in our classes. You just kind of start pulling the small intestine out of the fatty lining that it's in, and it comes out of it like a sock, and then you squeeze out what's inside of it like a tube of toothpaste, and then you take a pastry knife, you know, like those square dough cutters that are good for scraping cutting boards. It's basically a square of stainless steel. And you hold down one end of the intestine, and you scrape it from the outside, and you will squeeze out the inside, the inner pink mucosal lining, like a tube of toothpaste. And it'll be, you know, it's clean when it's completely transparent, when you hold it up and you can see through it. And it's then it's ready for sausage casing. And it's a brilliant, it's the perfect apparatus for making salami and sausage, because it's a one-way valve. In the pig, it only lets water-soluble nutrients out of the intestines. You know, the small intestine is like kind of the end of the line for the nutrients that go right into the blood. And so when you stuff meat in it and then you hang it and you let it ferment, only water comes out. It is it only lets it dry out. It doesn't let anything go in. It's brilliant. Incredibly bold. The first person that decided to use it that way, and it happened to work perfectly.
Lungs.
Lungs are good. They're paradoxically very tough. They feel light as air, but they're very tough. And so I think they're mild in flavor. People say lungs are disgusting, but I feel like they're not being prepared correctly or something, which is pretty typical. All of the offal, if it's not fresh, it's not going to be good. It's got to be fresh, like day of or next day. That's offal. That's the good stuff.
Which is definitely shown in your video, but not really mentioned much in this video.
Yeah. Freshness is essential.
Yeah, your video focuses a lot on, you know, Ebenezer, and it's like, okay, so this is harvest day, mm-hmm. and so then we all eat, you know, the organs today.
Yeah.
And then the rest of this is all for in the future.
Yeah.
And basically there's kind of like a seasonality to it. I mean, we talk about eating seasonally, and it's like there are certain cuts that you're going to eat 2 months into the future,
right.
and there are certain cuts that you have to eat today.
Yeah.
So I thought that was covered really well in your video. One of the things in today's video that came up was, like, we saw a lot of breadcrumbs being worked into different
mm-hmm.
kinds of things,
yeah.
and then somebody said, before you use those breadcrumbs, you have to make sure that you toast them.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, there could still be active yeast in those breadcrumbs,
yeah.
and that'll ruin everything.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting, too. It makes perfect sense. You don't want yeast in salami. You just want lactic bacteria. You know, yeast is a fungus, and it will start eating sugars, too, and creating carbon dioxide. You don't want air bubbles in the salami. That would be no good. Yeah, I never thought of that. But, yeah, the breadcrumb thing is totally, that's so British, you know. British bangers. That is their regional thing. Is breadcrumbs in their sausage, which I've had. It's absolutely delicious. It's a great idea.
It's like the hot dog, but the bun is inside.
Yeah.
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 it's the bunless hot dog. It's
yeah.
it's already in there. Okay. the last note that I have is that at the end they kept doing all these recipes and they kept doing all this cooking. And this woman made a dish, and she's like, and now I'm going to fry it in olive oil.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of thought, no. Olive oil, you're supposed to consume that raw only. And when you heat olive oil, it, like, makes it wonky and not as good. And plus, it's like, why not use lard? Why aren't you, like, if you're going to fry a little bit of pork, I mean, We've got this ocean of pig here that we're demonstrating. Why not, you know, put a little lard in there?
Yeah, I think she was being true to the recipe, I think, because that is a particularly Italian thing. And I can't remember how I know that, but the braising the loin in milk is of Italian tradition, and I think that it was probably part of that specific treatment to brown it in olive oil, which does impart a nuttiness to the brown meat.
Right, a particular kind of flavor, which I guess if 80% of your diet is olive oil,
right.
then it was like, no, if it doesn't have olive oil, I don't want to eat it. It's
right.
like not food.
yeah.
It would be disrespectful to the dawn.
Right. yeah.
So I could die. Right, okay. I'm following now. I have to eat it in olive oil. That's the end of my notes. Who's got more notes?
You covered everything?
Richard, you don't have anything more?
Yeah, the only thing I want to say is, even Paul, we've covered it here, but the big thing is ethical treatment of the pigs and to keep them happy. Because, like you guys already said, it just makes everything healthy, and you just get a better quality.
And, of course, you know, what is ethical treatment is going to vary from human being to human being. But I think that, you know, most of us can agree that the factory thing is not cool. And then, plus, there's rules like if you smell anything, you're doing it wrong. And a variety of... And, of course, a pig is a forest animal. And granted, while they will tolerate a great deal, I kind of feel like once you put an animal into a cage... You are taking on the arrogance that you're going to improve upon Mother Nature's environment. And I think with that arrogance comes responsibility. And so you, the pig needs to end up having a better life than if it was running wild in the woods. And that's what's important to me. And granted, a lot of people are going to disagree with me and think I'm stupid or something. But that's it is a subjective, relative thing, ethical treatment of pigs.
Well, I think there's a big, besides the ethics of it, there's a big nutritional difference. And I think you might have touched on that a little bit, but interestingly enough, Hugh was talking about flavor and healthy, but he didn't go into a lot about the nutrition of it. But and we've mentioned it in the past, I think, Paul, about how pastured pigs or pigs raised outdoors have far more vitamin D. They're like the next best source of pig fat. It's like the next best source of vitamin D next to the sun or something, right?
Yeah.
When they're, and then the saturated fats are healthy for you. We've talked a lot about that. And so Hugh didn't mention that a lot, but I think there's a huge piece there that I think a lot of Americans especially still aren't coming to terms with, how healthy pork can be and how healthy saturated fat can be.
Yeah. Well, one of the things from your video, Brandon, was that you had a mention where it's like if you feed pigs sweet corn, was it sweet corn or it's field corn count too? But they then the pork tastes like candy.
Yeah, and that was in the context of you know the beginning of the pig in America, and so because that's an interesting topic, you know, the pigs did thrive on corn. And I'm sure positive it was not the monocrop that we're thinking of, as, that we think of as corn today, because this is right when they were brought, you know, several generations after they were brought to America, the Americas. And there was this grass that seemed to fatten them pretty rapidly, and corn will absolutely do that. The problem today is that corn is completely impoverished and from its original, you know, diversified glory. And most of pig feeds are soy and corn-based, both of which are really high in polyunsaturated fat. And so if you're feeding the pig a feed that is almost exclusively composed of those things to enhance rapid weight gain, their fat, polyunsaturated fat in pork is flabby. It's not stiff at all. It's mushy and flabby, and it has no structure, and it's not pure white. And it doesn't cure well. It doesn't hang and dry well. It turns into mush when you try to put it in sausage. That's what contributes to the pastiness of sausage. If the pork is flabby going into the grinder, it's going to come out as paste going out. But if it's if you're putting in to the pig lots of good feed that, you know, a balance of polyunsaturated and saturated fats, the flesh is rigid and strong, and the fat is pure white, and it has structure, and it's delicious, and it doesn't get rancid as quickly and as easily. And that's the stuff that pigs get from a diversified diet. You know, they're going to get lots of saturated fats from the plants and the roots that they're eating. And if you wanted to, the best cereal base or, you know, hog mash base for grain feeding pigs is barley and peas, because they have the lowest percentage of unsaturated fat, you know, that so it will just enhance the quality of the pork meat significantly.
That reminds me that when Sepp Holzer wants to move pigs and encourage pigs to do anything, then he uses field peas, which have been soaking in kitchen scraps for a few hours, and so they get a little stink to them, and then he'll throw the dried field peas out.
Yeah.
And wherever he wants the pigs to go, or if he wants the pigs to follow him, then and I'm kind of thinking, like, I can see pigs totally going for that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, what else we got? Anything? It's a wrap. If you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about raising hogs, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.